Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
Hey, Chris. Great to see you back after the new year. Happy New Year to you.
Good to see you as well, Father Daniel.
Yeah, there's a lot of things happening. You had a cool trip to Morocco. I got to visit my parents in Arkansas. Different parts of the world, a little bit different climate, but also some big things happened in politics. With everything blowing up in Venezuela and toppling of Maduro and taking him for extradition. I mean, some pretty crazy things have been happening.
Yes, a very complex, a complex topic that I think we'll tackle that next week as it's sort of still developing.
That's a good idea. That gives us a little more time to think about it, pray about it, get some perspective. But stay tuned, everyone, for next week. Chris and I are going to talk about Venezuela a little bit more in depth.
This week, though, we're going to open with a topic that was more about what was going on last year.
Okay.
So a new moral framework seems to be emerging in recent times, as it seems the Judeo-Christian-based concepts of morality are being threatened with the ancient pagan views that predated them.
Yeah.
If you look at the late 2024 killing of United Health CEO Brian Thompson and the near cult status that his alleged killer Luigi Mangione seems to now enjoy.
Right. And if I remember correctly, that was because he was looking for some insurance payouts and didn't get what he wanted. And so he felt entitled to kill the guy.
Presumably.
Yeah.
Right. And then you go to the obviously infamous Charlie Kirk murder of last year, where many public figures made it clear that they thought it was okay. And several commentators had responses along the lines of, I hope the bullet's okay, when it touched Charlie's neck.
Gosh.
Right? These insensitive comments.
Yeah.
So following that, you had the Virginia Attorney General election of Jay Jones, who fantasized about killing his political opponents.
Mm-hmm.
And the killing in New York of a Blackstone senior exec who oversaw a real estate investment fund. And then podcaster Sean McCarthy justified the killing when he said, quote, New York City is so evil that if you walk into a random big building and do a mass shooting, there's decent odds you'll hit the person in charge of buying up single family homes for Blackstone, unquote.
Wow. He actually said that.
And then Blackstone, of course, put up posts mourning the murdered executive. And many of the anonymous replies were along the lines of expressing glee at her death because they, in their minds, said she was responsible for contributing to high housing costs.
Hmm.
So the pagan world that existed prior to the time of Moses and his handing down of the Ten Commandments was, I would say, for many, for multiple reasons, incompatible with the building and sustaining of civilization.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You have in some theories,
constant spiral down of violence.
Right.
We've seen it in cultures all throughout history.
Right. And so some theories suggest that God handed down the Ten Commandments to begin the process of civilizing the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think the devil is somehow, after all these millennia, trying to get us to revert to some pre-Moses worldview?
Of course he is. He's always trying to bring us down into chaos and disorder. And God's law brings order and chaos and the building up of society. We can see this, Chris, not just in one corner of the planet. You can see it. If you're an avid student of history, you see this repeated over and over again. And we kind of live under the delusion of progress. We think that we're such an advanced culture and society that we can't degrade into some of the things that have taken place in other cultures and societies throughout the world, which have rejected a Christian worldview. And I think that's delusional. We are just as capable of slipping back into paganism as every other generation and every other place has been. So we don't have some sort of special thing in our water in the United States that protects us from demagoguery or from falling into paganism. And in fact, whenever we see these manifestations creeping into our society, there is a degradation of understanding of human dignity, this willingness to kill people just for any cause.
Yeah, and so let's talk about that. So what was the demarcation between Moses' handing down of the Ten Commandments and what existed prior? So what existed prior, in my mind, was more about whatever the ruling king's power was. Like, there was still the it was still wrong to kill, but it was really based more on the on the protection of the king, or you know, just that you didn't want to have any kind of unrest in the kingdom. It wasn't about your conscience.
Yeah, we'll go even further back. The book of Genesis has a progression where you have, you know, Cain killing Abel, so fratricide, and then you have all of the debauchery that took place around that time, where you can see right after the killing of Abel by Cain, there's a degradation of humanity, and it becomes just might is right. If you can kill someone else and take their stuff, you go ahead and do it. And then you have the law of the talion, which came in, which actually predates the Israelites. It came from other the cultures at the time. The law of the talion was to limit that retribution and revenge and say, okay, if someone takes your eye out, you can take their eye out. And that was the law of the talion. It was tit for tat. And then the law of Moses progresses beyond that, and God's pedagogy of teaching his people. It's like, no, let's have a rule of law.
And but that's the one defining commandment that is different than any of the other laws that may have existed prior was do not covet, which is more about your intention and your conscience rather than what you did, you know, whether your action. And so that is a main demarcation point in my mind on everything that happened going forward. And now and why I'm going to relate that to what's going on with this new license to kill. You know, the people are killing thinking it's justified. Okay.
Because they're justifying it in their own minds because of a wrong way of thinking.
Yeah. Right. Right. And it's not just breaking of this, you know, law of against killing, but now we're talking about the why is different than, you know, with this, I guess this is a little different in recent times than what we've seen over, you know, the last few hundred years of people think, you know, honestly thinking that for non-political purposes, maybe, you know, they might think it's okay to kill, to overthrow some king who is oppressing them. But an individual, you know, like the Blackstone exec, they're killing and honestly justifying it because they think that she's responsible for single family housing prices going up.
Yeah, but that's not so different from a lot of what's been going on for the last 150 years with Marxist and socialist mentality. I mean, when you have a whole worldview which justifies revolution, overthrowing governments, causing the death of millions of people. I mean, in the last 100 years, we've seen 100 million people die under socialist collectivist mentalities, which justify and codify that envy and overthrow and killing those that you know, you feel envious towards.
So maybe last year wasn't so different than.
No, it's just that we're seeing it more and more in our societies. We become less Christian.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Recently, a non-Catholic buddy of mine was showing me a picture he had taken at the Church of the Assumption in Jerusalem, where in Orthodox tradition, the Virgin Mary died a natural death like any human being, and that after 3 days, her body was resurrected and she was taken up body and soul to heaven.
I think that's the Church of the Dormition.
Okay,
is that what Assumption. It's? Yeah, it's a beautiful church right next to the Mount of Olives.
And
you go down these long series of steps down into the depths of the earth. Really beautiful down there, very somber, a prayerful environment.
Yeah. Okay, well, the Roman Catholic teaching requires that, as opposed to the Eastern Orthodox, that Mary was assumed, they both teach this, but the Roman Catholic thinking is that Mary was assumed into heaven, body and soul. However, it's not dogmatically defined whether or not she died first, whereas the Eastern Orthodox tradition says that she did die and was then assumed into heaven. So I've always been under the belief that Mary was assumed into heaven before dying and that she was assumed at Ephesus in modern day Turkey. And that was based on the 19th century visions of Blessed Anne Catherine Emmerich. And several popes have visited that site, but the church has not declared it definitive, you know, as to whether or not. So I was always under the assumption that she did not die. And I was under that assumption, one, based on these visions, but two, that since there was no original sin for Mary, that she did not die. What do you think?
Well, my thinking is with the church, there's kind of hesitation without defining it. We won't know until we get to heaven definitively. And so it's hard for us to make any declaration right now because the church leaves it kind of open-ended in that regard. I think.
What about Jerusalem versus Ephesus?
I think that, again, the possibility there, people traveled just like we do today. People traveled to different places. So it's entirely possible for Mary to have gone and lived in Ephesus, which we know from his archaeological fact that they found her house, you know, that's located there, that she clearly lived for a time in Ephesus. Could she have gone back to Jerusalem and died there? It's entirely possible. I mean, that happened with other apostles, with other people in the early church. So there was a frequentation of visits. I think you bring up an interesting point, though, Chris. You know, with a private revelation, you know, the Blessed Catherine and Emmerich, who had these visions, that's not doctrine of the church. It's one person's private revelation. And it can be edifying for the faith of the faithful, but it's not necessary for our belief. So in a lot of those cases, too, when different people have had visions over the years throughout the history of the church, you know, sometimes they can add to our faith, but they're not necessary. So I wouldn't base any doctrinal declarations on a vision of a saint.
A December Wall Street Journal article details delays boarding a recent flight from Guadalajara to the U.S. in what's become an all too common occurrence that almost anyone who travels will recognize. There was no weather issue or crew shortage causing the delay, but instead it was the 25 wheelchair passengers who had to board first before others could do the traditional boarding by zone.
25.
Upon arrival to the destination, virtually none of the 25 passengers who boarded by a wheelchair needed any such assistance when they disembarked. The phenomenon is known in travel circles as the intercession of Jetway Jesus.
This is the first I've heard of this. I love hearing about modern day miracles. Tell me more about this,
Miracle
Chris.
Flights have caused particular issues for Southwest Airlines, where the lack of assigned seating, which is going away here, I think, soon, creates the extra incentive to game the system. Some Southwest flights can have as much as one third of the seats on a plane taken by early wheelchair boarders. Hmm. So what do you think about the unusual number of miracles that are taking place on airport jetways?
Oh, this is hilarious. Chris, I love miracles, but I don't think this is a miracle.
What?
No, I think this is more of people gaming the system. It's a reflection on the integrity of the people who are trying to cheat the system by saying that they need a wheelchair. I think that's more indicative of something that's a rot.
Gosh, you're so
in
skeptical.
I know. I'd like to poke holes in things. I am a little bit of a
skeptic. All right, so seriously, though, what's worse, pulling these shenanigans or being one of the people who has a handicapped parking placard hanging on their rearview mirror that gets in and out of the car with seemingly no discernible
well, I've seen quite a few of those,
right,
too.
Which one's worse?
Oh, gosh. Man, I think probably the prior one, because it's just more blatant.
I think the airport one's worse.
Yeah.
Everybody else has to wait. I think what they ought to do is anybody who enters by wheelchair ought to be put in the back of the plane and have to wait until everybody else is off to then get off.
That's
the plane
a great
yourself.
Idea. That'd be a disincentive for people to try to game the system that way.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. According to a Wall Street Journal analysis of Medicare data, 1 in 6 of the 46 million seniors enrolled in Medicare's drug benefit were prescribed 8 or more medications.
8 or more. Wow.
Of those, 3.9 million seniors were taking at least 10 drugs or more.
Mm-hmm.
And more than 419,000 of them were on at least 15 drugs.
Wow. That's crazy. I was just talking yesterday with a guy who is dying of cancer, and he said he was on 10 medications, and he thought that was a lot.
Yeah.
So for seniors to be on that many medications is kind of insane.
Right, and for like vast swaths of the senior population,
yeah,
right?
And for
millions and millions and millions.
For the foreseeable future, this isn't a short-term medication. They're keeping them on that medication long-term.
The journal found that doctors who prescribed the most drugs were concentrated in rural areas across the southern U.S.
Hmm.
So why do I bring this up? So in addition to normalizing the idea that it might be acceptable to take as, you know, so many drugs, you know, there's also the issue of the unknown effect of mixing multiple medications,
sure.
Right?
It's a real
taking
problem.
15 at once, there's certainly no way they can know what these things are interacting,
right,
you know, how they're interacting with each other. So just what are your thoughts about this culturally, that maybe we should be looking at growing old with more acceptance of in the things that comes with growing old rather than taking 15 drugs? Thoughts?
It's a great thought, Chris. And I think it comes with, are we truly living with a Christian worldview? I find oftentimes that people are so averse to any type of suffering that they have really not accepted the message of the cross. And actually, this really struck me. I was at a parish over the holidays, and the pastor kept talking and praying for the health of people. And it struck me that he was praying so much for the health of people. It's like, wait a second, shouldn't we be praying for people to get right with God, be ready for their passing? If we're so attached to this life and to our health, I think we're missing the point. I mean, life is short. We're made for eternity. We're not made just for this life. And if we put all of our stock here, we're not putting it in the right place. I was just reading a homily from St. John Chrysostom this morning in my meditation, and he was talking about this reality. He says, like, because he was chastising the Christians of his time in the 300s for putting too much stock and saying, oh, people are getting away with things in this life, and maybe they won't suffer in the next. He's like, no. You know, this life is short. No matter how long it is, in light of eternity, it is nothing. So if we have to suffer a little bit here in order to attain the glory of eternal life, great. And I think as in a modern society, if we're losing that eternal perspective and we're trying to avoid any suffering or inconvenience, yeah, we're going to seek medications, we're going to look for things, and then it's going to cause other problems. And we're going to suffer because of over-medication, we're going to suffer from the side effects. And we all know people that are going through that. My dad's going through that right now because he's had a number of health issues. And I was just talking with him the other day, and he's had these complications because of interactions of medications. Okay, so I think there's something to what you're saying, Chris.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. By now, everyone knows that Rob Reiner, who was the son of Hollywood legend Carl Reiner, and his wife were murdered by their own son in a gruesome mid-December incident in their own home.
Mm.
Their alleged murderer son, Nick, was a screenwriter, mostly known for his 2015 movie called Being Charlie, which was an autobiopic depiction of his own struggles with addiction.
Mm.
Actor Michael Douglas, who was also the son of a Hollywood legend, dealt for years with drug-related issues from his son Cameron, who spent 7 years in prison for dealing heroin. Nepo baby Sean Penn, son of Hollywood screenwriter Leo Penn, lost his brother and fellow actor Chris at the age of 40 when he OD'd on a cocktail of drugs after a long history of drug abuse.
Right.
Scott Newman, the only son of Paul Newman, died of a drug overdose in 1978 at the age of 28. Charlie Sheen, son of Martin Sheen, struggled for decades with drug addiction and suffered a near-fatal stroke after a cocaine overdose in 1998. So the list of actors and actresses who overdose on drugs or end up in jail because of their drug abuse goes on and on and on and on. And in particular, for the ones who are sons and daughters of other actors and actresses. So do you think this irresistible pull of vanity is just too powerful to overcome? Like, why would anyone in their right mind aspire, who wants to be a mom and dad, aspire to a Hollywood career knowing that what's going to happen to your children is most likely going to be a bad outcome?
Yeah, that's a great question, Chris. Yeah, there's so many. It's a sad pattern that people in that lifestyle get pulled into the drugs and the addictions. But it's not just there in Hollywood. I see the pattern played out also in, families right here in Atlanta, a lot of well-to-do families. Dad's a, very successful corporate executive, and the kids get pulled into drugs. So I think it has to do with some other internal factors that are going on within the family. It's not just the vanity of the Hollywood lifestyle. A lot of times it's the affluence. Sometimes it's the pressure of having to
achieve. Sure, it happens everywhere, but it happens in particularly frequently in Hollywood.
It does, yeah.
So is it, and so my question really is, though, is that if you're a Hollywood actor or actress, or you're aspiring to be this person, and you know that you want to have a family, and you
know.
Do
they know that, though?
What's that?
Do they know that, though?
I mean, it's been happening since the advent of Hollywood. This is not just right. Like this generation.
Mm-hmm.
It's been happening ever since they started, filming
but
people.
But my question is valid. Do they know that they want to be a parent? I'm not so sure. I think that sometimes they're actually, because I've met a lot of actors and actresses, and oftentimes they're driven by a need for validation from others. that they're really seeking the limelight. They're seeking the vanity. And it's not so much a life given to parenting and serving others.
Back to my original question, is the vanity pull just that strong?
I think it's a significant factor psychologically for a lot of these people, definitely.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com. Crosswires.
We speak often about inconsistencies between current Christian toleration of Islam versus the vice versa, like the story we did a couple weeks ago about how the Vatican was providing a Muslim prayer room in the official library, and how that would never happen at a similar Islamic site. Well, let's look at another religion that has increasingly been antagonistic in their disposition towards Christians. Since Narendra Modi became India's prime minister in 2014, the country has seen a big rise in violence by Hindus against religious minorities. India's Muslims, who are 14% of the population, have mostly been the targets of these attacks. But recently, there have been several incidents against Christians who make up just 2.3% of the population.
And not just recently. This has been going on for a long time. It's just more recently come to our attention. But this has been going on because I've talked with people who are in India and Pakistan and those neighboring countries, and they are receiving anti-Catholic persecution on an ongoing basis.
Okay. Well, as many as 12 of the 28 states that make up India have laws prohibiting religious conversion by, quote, force or allurement, unquote. So the latter of which is defined as any form of evangelical persuasion. Attacks on Christians are justified on this basis as a way to stop conversions.
And it's so easy to see how that could be used to justify anything. Like if you, I don't know, you had a beautiful music at your church, they could say that's allurement. And so it's such, I mean, that's open to really abusive interpretation.
Well, why this is in the news is there's a recent cell phone video clip that has made the rounds where it shows the leader of one of the two main political parties in India barging into a church to disrupt a Christmas feast and physically and verbally assaulting a young blind Christian woman who she's an Indian woman because she thought she was converting Hindus to Christianity. In another incident in 2024, a Hindu mob of 200 people attacked 18 Christian families in an Indian state whose name I won't even attempt to pronounce.
That's brave of you.
But the police didn't intervene. They just let it happen. Right. So India has a secularism enshrined in its constitution. So, you know, what it brings to mind, the question for me is, and that secularism has been since they declared their independence in 1950. How would a Mother Teresa fare in today's current day India in the climate that's of the current day?
I mean, she would be persecuted just like everyone else. And I have no doubt that she did face some persecution at different points. But it's interesting, though, how in India the Hinduism is often tied to a nationalism. And so it's the rise.
But secularism is enshrined in their constitution.
It is, hypothetically. But you know how things get in everyday life. Things get all mishmashed together. And so this rise of Hinduism is oftentimes tied to a nationalism. Like they feel, at least some of them do, because I've talked with people from India who understand their own culture better than I do. And they say in some cases that people feel like they're, by being Hindu, they're being more Indian. They're being more faithful to their national heritage. And so they want to push out anything that's not Hinduism and basically put in these laws and ways to push them out of the country.
That might answer my next question then. So my next question is, are Hindu and Muslim majority nations really any different than what Christians did during the Crusades or during the Spanish Inquisition? And I would say that during the Spanish Inquisition in particular, that it was that nationalism overlap that maybe was driving what was happening. But you know, as Christians in recent times, we're different. But you know, historically, are we any different?
I think we are. I think at least from a scriptural standpoint, there is significant grounds in the teachings of Christ for acceptance of others and respect for the dignity of other people. In Hinduism, you have the caste system, which has perpetuated a lack of respect for human dignity. In Islam, you have people who are not of the followers of Allah who are a second-class citizen, so also not respecting human dignity. This is a fundamental difference between other religions and Christianity.
So I guess what you're saying is that structurally Christianity is different, and that we have just acted poorly as Christians versus clearly the structure of Islam and Hinduism maybe.
That's exactly what I'm saying. So at its core, when you look at the scriptures of, well, Hinduism doesn't really have scriptures, but they're sacred writings and things. There's no sense of human dignity in the same way that we have it within Christianity, as well as in Islam. So that's a fundamental difference, and it makes all the difference in the world. Because then, when as a Christian, yes, there will be Christians all the time who violate what they should be doing and how they should be living. And we can look at lots of instances throughout
history where that's the case. Well, there's a difference between bad actors and bad constitution.
Exactly. So, and that's what we're talking about. We've got bad actors within Christianity, but a great constitution. We have a great rule of law. We have a great approach which respects the dignity of every human person. It seeks the solidarity and the fraternity among all people. And when that's enshrined in Christian ways of governance, it goes well for countries. So there's development, there's growth, there's progress. Whereas when you see these systems of repression put into place that don't respect human dignity, what do you have? You have caste systems. You have second-tier citizens. And this is a fundamental difference between Hinduism, Islam, and Christianity.
We've talked about nature rights before. In a first now for environmental law, two Peruvian Amazonian provinces have officially recognized native stingless bees as rights-bearing entities. This decision marks the first time in history that an insect has been granted legal rights. Among the rights granted, one, the right to exist and thrive. Two, the right to a healthy habitat. Three, stable climatic conditions. And four, legal representation. So bees can now be represented in court by people.
Wait a second. That's not fair. They should be represented by fellow bees.
Why these types of bees instead of European honeybees? Well,
it makes no sense. This is so ridiculous.
I know, but you know, we've talked about it as though it's ridiculous, but it's happening.
I know. Gosh. What a world we live in.
Okay. If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crossed Wires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens on AM 1160, The Quest.